Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Tuesday, August 9. I'm your reader, Kathleen. The front page of the Gazette today, how the Inflation Reduction Act might affect you. This is a Washington Post story. Major changes to the Affordable Care Act. The nation's biggest ever climate bill, the largest tax hike on corporations in decades, and dozens of lesser-known provisions that will affect millions of Americans. The legislation Democrats on Sunday muscled through the Senate would represent one of the most consequential pieces of economic policy in recent U.S. history, though still far smaller than the $3 trillion the Biden administration initially sought. The Nonpartisan Committee for Responsible Federal Budget estimates the bill would put about $385 billion into combating climate change and bolstering U.S. energy production through changes that would encourage nearly the whole economy to cut carbon emissions. Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer, Democrat of New York, has said the bill would reduce carbon emissions by roughly 40% by 2030, close to President Joe Biden's goal of cutting U.S. emissions by at least half below 2005 levels. The agreement would also raise hundreds of billions in new revenue through new tax provisions, the biggest of which will fall on the country's largest corporations. Democrats failed in their earlier efforts to repeal Republicans' 2017 tax law. On health care, Democrats campaigned in 2020 on major changes, and this deal advances two of their major pledges, allowing Medicare to negotiate the price of prescription drugs and making health care more affordable for millions of Americans. But the prescription drug provisions were dialed back over the weekend after the Senate's parliamentarian ruled that Democrats' attempt to limit some drug prices to the rate of inflation ran afoul of the procedure the party used to pass the bill with a simple majority and bypass a filibuster. Republicans also defeated an attempt to set a broad price cap on insulin. The bill also left out many key policy ambitions of Democrats, excluding, for instance, plans for new child care, housing, elder care, and paid leave programs. But after months of gridlock and false starts, the House is expected Friday to give final approval. Republicans have warned that the measure will hurt the economy with higher taxes, as fears of a recession are growing. Steve Miron, who served as a senior official in the Treasury Department in the Trump administration, said the plan's tax provisions would exacerbate inflation by leading to a decline in supply. Here is a summary of some of what's included in the bill, according to Senate Democratic officials. Number one, $260 billion in clean energy tax credits. New and extended credits would incentivize solar, wind, hydropower, and other sources of renewable energy. Private firms and publicly owned utilities could get tax subsidies both for the production of renewable energy and for manufacturing a specific part essential to a renewable project, such as wind, turbine, or solar panels. The goal? To make new green energy production cheaper for utilities to build than fossil fuel plants. Number two, $80 billion in new rebates for electric vehicles, green energy. Buyers of new electric vehicles would get a $7,500 tax credit applied at the point of sale. That also would apply to vehicles whose manufacturers are no longer eligible for an existing EV credit, such as Tesla and General Motors. Couples who earn less than $300,000 a year or individuals who earn less than $150,000 would be eligible. A $4,000 tax credit also would apply to purchases of used EVs. Tens of millions of people will qualify for the credits. Other consumer rebates would subsidize the installation of more efficient heat pumps and water heaters, up to as much as $14,000 in total rebates. Installation of home solar panels would be eligible for a 30% credit until 2032, when that would drop to 26% through 2034. Additional consumer subsidies include $840 for an electric induction cooktop and up to $9,100 for improvements to electric panels, wiring, and home installation. Number three, $1.5 billion in rewards for cutting methane emissions. A methane emissions reduction program would reward oil and gas companies that slash their emissions of methane and penalize those who don't. The program, crafted by Senate Environment and Public Works Chair Thomas Carper, a Democrat from Delaware, originally would have provided $775 million upfront to oil and gas companies to cut their methane emissions. The current agreement doubles that to $1.5 billion, according to the Senate Democratic aide. Methane traps far more heat in the atmosphere than carbon dioxide. Number 4, support for fossil fuel projects. Democratic leadership pledged to mandate new oil and gas leasing in the Gulf of Mexico and off the coast of Alaska, where industry groups are pushing for a major expansion in oil production. Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, whose support was critical to Democrats in passing the bill, views drilling in those areas as important to the country's domestic energy independence. Number 5 is agricultural, steel, ports, and more. The bill contains numerous smaller measures aimed at specific parts of the economy with high emissions. $20 billion for agriculture subsidies to help farmers reduce emissions. $6 billion to reduce emissions in chemical, steel, and cement plants. And $3 billion to reduce air pollution at ports. Number 6 is hundreds of billions from a 15% corporate minimum tax. The biggest tax hike in the plan would apply to all U.S. corporations that earn more than $1 billion per year in profits. Under current law, U.S. corporations ostensibly pay a 21% tax rate, but dozens of Fortune 500 companies pay no federal income tax at all by claiming deductions for things such as research and development. The plan would attempt to close off that option by subjecting large corporations to a tax on their financial statements. Corporations still would be able to claim tax credits, though, since renewable energy groups raised concerns the minimum tax could undercut the effectiveness of the climate tax credit. Number 7 is a $124 billion that comes from enforcement increases at the IRS. The IRS would scale up dramatically in an attempt to close the tax gap, the difference between what people and corporations owe and what they actually pay. Democrats say that their plan to invest $80 billion in the IRS would more than pay for itself, in part because the tax agency's budget was cut by 20% between 2010 and 2020. Former IRS Commissioner Charles Rossotti and current Treasury official Natasha Sarin previously estimated the IRS could raise $1.4 trillion in additional tax revenues with more funding. But Republicans say it represents a political vulnerability for the administration if more Americans face IRS audits or other scrutiny. Number 8, a new tax on companies repurchasing their own shares. As part of their last-minute negotiations to win the support of Senator Kristen Sinema of Arizona, Democrats agreed to limit the extent of the corporate minimum tax and instead inserted a new tax on corporations that purchase shares of their own stocks. Democrats have for years complained that these buybacks enrich wealthy shareholders because a firm drives up the value of its stock by buying it. Liberal tax experts have said that rather than spending money to increase their stocks' values, large corporations should spend it on improving worker pay or investing in new research and development. The 1% tax on stock buybacks would raise roughly $73 billion, according to a Senate Democratic aide. Conservatives oppose the bill as likely to discourage investment. The provision also could hurt retirement pension plans, said John Karch, a spokesman for Americans for Tax Reform, a conservative group. Number 9, lowering prescription drug prices. The deal allows Medicare to negotiate drug prices for the first time and would prevent future administrations from refusing to do so. It's a major win for Democrats who have pledged to lower the cost of medicines, particularly for seniors. The government would start by negotiating the price of 10 drugs and scale up to 20 by 2029. But it isn't clear how many Americans with Medicare coverage would see lower out-of-pocket costs or how much money they could save. That depends on which drugs are negotiated and how much prices drop, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation. The bill also includes other policies aimed at curbing the sky-high cost of drugs. For instance, it caps seniors' drug costs under Medicare to $2,000 per year, forces drug companies to pay a rebate if they increase prices faster than the rate of inflation in Medicare, and provides free vaccines for seniors. The drug pricing components are a key money saver. Congressional scorekeepers estimated these policies would reduce the deficit by nearly $288 billion over a decade. The legislation would also impose a $35 monthly cap on the cost of insulin, which people with type 1 diabetes need to stay alive, and which many people with type 2 diabetes use to manage their blood sugar levels for patients enrolled in Medicare. Democrats had sought to extend the same cap to people with private insurance, but Republicans nixed such a policy on the Senate floor, arguing it didn't comply with the rules to avoid a filibuster. Number 10 is extending health insurance subsidies. Last year, Democrats' pandemic aid law boosted financial help for low-income Americans with plans on the Affordable Care Act's insurance exchange and extended the subsidies to middle-income earners for the first time. But the enhanced tax credits are set to expire at the end of this year, raising the specter of roughly 13 million Americans learning that their health premiums would soon increase just weeks before the elections. The deal would extend the tax credits for three more years through 2025. And finally, number 11, reducing the federal deficit. The original version of the legislation would have brought down the federal deficit by about $300 billion over 10 years, according to Mark Goldwyn, Senior Vice President of the Committee for Responsible Federal Budget. That would be more than any other legislation has done since 2011. The savings would shrink somewhat if Congress later extends the Affordable Care Act subsidies, which last for only a few years in the current version of the bill. Last-minute changes to the bill have altered some of the bill's components and the amount of money they raise. Democrats say it still is far more than needed to offset its costs, but party leaders had yet to furnish a final fiscal analysis. Also on the front page of the Gazette today, this story by Emily Anderson, City High honors custodian who drowned rescuing a boy. Mr. Ferris died a hero, the school superintendent says. City High School in Iowa City will honor a 17-year employee and wonderful human being who drowned Friday while trying to save a child from the Iowa River in southern Johnson County. Wegayewu Ferris, age 42, had been a custodian at City High since 2005, according to Principal John Bacon. The school will honor him with a plaque highlighting his story. He was just an absolutely wonderful human being, kind, caring, always took the time to stop and visit with staff and students. He was very much a caring presence in the building, an extremely hard worker. City High School is a historic, beautiful campus, and he took a lot of pride in helping take very good care of the building, Bacon said. Ferris was fishing Friday in the Iowa River at the River Junction access near Lone Tree when an 8-year-old boy who was not related to Ferris but also was fishing with family went into the river and began struggling. Ferris entered the river to save the child. With the help of Ferris and a nearby kayaker, the boy got safely out of the water, but Ferris became submerged. The kayaker and others began looking for him as law enforcement was called. Johnson County Sheriff's deputies located Ferris's body about an hour after he went into the water. The sheriff's office did not release the name of the boy nor the kayaker who pulled him from the water. Bystanders performed CPR on the child, and he was taken to the University of Iowa hospitals and clinics, according to Johnson County Sheriff Brad Kunkel. The boy was released from the hospital Saturday and is doing well. Bacon started working with Ferris about 12 years ago when Bacon became principal of City High in 2010. He said he plans to put a plaque, which will feature a picture of Ferris and tell the story of his work at the school and how he died, in the area of the school that was Ferris's custodial and maintenance responsibility. Bacon said he also has been doing his best to circulate a link to a GoFundMe page that was started by Ferris's sister-in-law, Bethel Tuwabi, in hopes that City High community members can help support Ferris's family. I think there's been a high degree of support that's been out there. I think many people are just moved and touched by the story of the bravery and courage that he showed. Just a selfless act of bravery, Bacon said. There's been an outpouring of love and support on social media, and I know the City High community will utilize the GoFundMe to help his family as well. According to the GoFundMe, Ferris had gone fishing Friday with his three children, ages 12, 8, and 6. He also has a wife, Teyabesta Tuwabi. The family is living in Coraville, but Ferris originally was from Ethiopia, and his family is hoping to use the money raised to transport his body back to Ethiopia to be laid to rest there. Ferris took care of everyone around him in any way that he could. He had a very big heart, hard-working hands, and a very determined mindset, and a smile that could brighten a dark room. He loved spending time with his family and friends, fishing, going on walks, and being outside in nature, the GoFundMe states. The GoFundMe had raised over $36,000 as of Monday afternoon. The Iowa City Community School District Superintendent Matt Degner released a statement praising Ferris's kindness and dedication. Our deepest sympathies go out to Mr. Ferris's family and friends. He died a hero and will forever be remembered for his brave and selfless actions. We will miss him deeply, Degner said. School counselors will be available at City High School in the coming days to help students and staff work through difficult emotions following the death, according to Degner. Turning to the Iowa Today page, here's a story from Duncansville, Pennsylvania. A major test of first Lyme shots in 20 years begins. Researchers are seeking thousands of volunteers in the U.S. and Europe to test the first potential vaccine against Lyme disease in 20 years, in hopes of better fighting the tick-borne threat. Lyme is a growing problem, with cases rising in warmer weather, helping ticks expand their habitat. In Iowa, the number of confirmed and suspected cases has been heading upward, reaching a combined total of 356 cases in 2021, the highest number in at least 12 years, according to the state health officials. Most of the cases in Iowa are on the eastern side of the state, with Johnson County having the state's fifth highest per capita incidence rate. While a vaccine for dogs has long been available, the only Lyme vaccine for humans was pulled from the U.S. market in 2002 because of a lack of demand, leaving people to rely on bug spray and tick checks instead. Now, Pfizer and French biotech Valneva are aiming to avoid previous pitfalls in developing a new vaccine to protect both adults and kids as young as 5 from the most common Lyme strains. There wasn't such a recognition, I think, of the severity of Lyme disease and how many people it affects the last time around, Pfizer vaccine chief Annalisa Anderson told the AP. Robert Terwilliger, an avid hunter and hiker, was first in line Friday when the study opened in central Pennsylvania. He's seen lots of friends get Lyme and is tired of wondering if his next tick bite will make him sick. It's always a worry, you know, especially when you're sitting in a tree stand hunting and you feel something crawling on you, he said. Exactly how often Lyme disease strikes isn't clear. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention cites insurance records suggesting 476,000 people are treated for Lyme each year in the nation. Pfizer's Anderson put Europe's yearly infections at about 130,000. Black-legged ticks, also called deer ticks, carry Lyme-causing bacteria. The infection initially causes fatigue, fever, and joint pain. Often, but not always, the first sign is a red, round bullseye rash. Early antibiotic treatment is critical, but it can be hard for people to tell if they've been bitten by ticks, some as small as a pin. Untreated Lyme can cause severe arthritis and damage the heart and nervous system. Some people have lingering symptoms after treatment. Most vaccines against other diseases work after people are exposed to a germ. The Lyme vaccine offers a different strategy, working a step earlier to block a tick bite from transmitting the infection, said Dr. Gary Wormser, a Lyme expert at New York Medical College who isn't involved in the new research. How? It targets an outer surface protein of the Lyme bacterium called OSPA that's present in the tick's gut. It's estimated a tick must feed on someone for about 36 hours before the bacteria spreads to its victim. That delay gives time for antibodies the tick ingests from a vaccinated person's blood to attack the germs. In small early-stage studies, Pfizer and Valneva reported no safety problems and a good immune response. The newest study will test if the vaccine, called VLA-15, really protects and is safe. The companies aim to recruit at least 6,000 people in Lyme-prone areas. They'll receive three shots, either the vaccine or a placebo, between now and next spring's tick season. A year later, they'll get a single booster dose. We're really looking at something that's a seasonal vaccine, Anderson said, so people have high antibody levels during the months when ticks are active. Volunteers can be as young as 5 and should be at high risk because they spend a lot of time in tick-infested areas, such as hikers, campers, and hunters, said Dr. Alan Kivitz, who heads one of the study sites at Altoona Center in Clinical Research, Duncansville, Pennsylvania. The Associated Press Health and Science Department receives support from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute's Department of Science Education. Turning now to the Insight page, the guest editorial today is a reprint from Friday's St. Louis Post-Dispatch, and the title, An About-Face on PACT Act. How angry are some Republicans at what they see as betrayal by a centrist Democrat? Angry enough to betray sick military veterans, apparently. That's the only rational explanation for the sudden about-face by 24 Senate Republicans who opposed legislation they previously supported to make it easier for cancer-stricken veterans to get help from the government. Facing ferocious public pushback, GOP senators who about-faced again last week, resuming their previous support for the measure and passing it Tuesday. But this shouldn't be mistaken for an all's well that ends well story. What the episode reveals about the partisan insolence and general dysfunction infecting one of America's two major political parties is beyond disturbing. At issue was the PACT Act, a long-sought measure to streamline the process of getting federal health care benefits to millions of veterans sickened by toxins released by burn pits for chemical and biological refuse and other sources. The cost of less than $30 billion a year is the least American could do for those who have served and fallen ill. Most of the Senate thought so when the measure passed overwhelmingly with strong bipartisan support in June. When the bill returned to the Senate for a procedural revote July 28, it appeared headed for easy reapproval. Instead, 25 Republican senators who had previously supported it voted against overcoming a filibuster, effectively stalling the measure. Republicans claimed it was because the bill was written in a way that could usher in hundreds of millions of dollars in unrelated spending, a claim the bill's supporters deny. Why did those 25 Republicans support it in the first place? Their reversal came just hours after top Democrats announced a deal with centrist Senator Joe Manchin, Democrat of West Virginia, to approve a health care, climate, and tax package that Manchin had previously opposed. Republicans were livid at what they considered a double-cross by their favorite Democrat. Republicans' sudden reversal of their previous support for the veterans' bill had an icy sheen of vengeance. Today's GOP is so all-consumed with digging ideological trenches and meting out partisan payback that it would betray sickened veterans to do it, subsequently scurrying to pass the bill only because of a well-deserved backlash doesn't hide but spotlights how indefensible this game was. And again, that's a reprint from the St. Louis Dispatch. The guest column today by David Helvarg and Jason Scores is titled Effect of Climate Bill on Oceans. The Inflation Reduction Act, IRA, announced in late July by Senators Chuck Schumer and Joe Manchin and passed by the Senate Sunday, includes $369 billion in tax incentives to boost wind, solar, and other clean energy. The bill will not by itself be enough to keep global warming under 1.5 degrees Celsius by 2050. To make bigger gains more quickly, we'll need to directly remove carbon from the atmosphere. We can start by focusing on the world's largest carbon sink, our ocean, which absorbs over 90% of the heat generated by the burning of fossil fuels. If not for the ocean, the Earth's average temperature would rise from 57 degrees to 122. The United States has begun to address ocean issues such as overfishing and pollution in its exclusive economic zone, which stretches 200 nautical miles, which is 230 miles, off the nation's coastline. But sea level rise, saltwater intrusion, ocean acidification, and other climate change impacts already threaten the ocean's ability to capture carbon. The IRA, of course, does benefit the ocean. The billions it would invest in speeding up the green energy transition, including offshore wind, will undoubtedly have a ripple effect on ocean health. It also contains provisions that are more directly targeted at coastal repair, like $2.6 billion in grants to states and tribal governments to help restore kelp beds, mangrove forests, salt marshes, and seagrasses, each of which are critical to carbon sequestration. Additionally, the bill sets aside $3 billion for cities to electrify their ports and reduce air pollution for fence-line neighbors of toxic industrial sites, which tend to be low-income communities of color. And more than $700 million would go toward new funding for the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, improving its efforts at climate and atmospheric forecasting. Manchin insisted that the bill include concessions for the oil and gas industry. Key among these accommodations is a stipulation that the U.S. Department of Interior must lease at least 60 million acres of offshore ocean waters for fossil fuel drilling every year in regions including the Gulf of Mexico and Alaska before allowing offshore wind leases to go through. And yet, this may not be as bad as it sounds. The oil industry is showing little interest in new ocean drilling, while the offshore wind industry is booming. The reality is the IRA could be the biggest investment in climate policy in U.S. history so far and get America back in the game as a global climate leader. To more fully address the climate crisis, President Joe Biden also can follow through on his commitment to create a National Ocean Climate Action Plan. This would help maximize federal efforts at ensuring our public seas contribute to reducing greenhouse gas emissions, while also helping buffer communities from the growing climate impacts. The good news is the tide finally seems to be turning. And the authors, David Helvarg, is the executive director of Blue Frontier, an ocean conservation group, and co-host of the Rising Tide Ocean podcast. Jason Scores is director of the Center for Blue Economy at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. One community letter today is titled, Senators Grassley and Ernst Voted Against a Bipartisan Gun Bill. Our two senators have shown us they do not respect the wishes of their constituents. The great majority of Iowans, like the majority of citizens in our country, believe in the right of our citizens to be protected from guns in public places. I have written and called our senators regarding the slaughter of children in schools and always get the answer regarding the Second Amendment to the Constitution. When between 60% and 70% of our citizens believe we need to do something to change what is killing so many of our people, our Congress has to do something about it. Fortunately, after decades of doing nothing, Congress passed a bipartisan bill which will start to make us safer. Too bad it took the lives of 19 innocent children and two teachers, and the horrible description that the bullets from the AR-15-style weapon did such terrible damage to the children's bodies that they were unrecognizable and decapitated. Senator Chuck Grassley voted against this bill. He and Senator Joni Ernst have benefited from hundreds of thousands of dollars, which they received from the National Rifle Association through the years. I believe assault weapons have no place in our society. They are weapons of war. We need to pick leaders who will practice what democracy stands for, the will of the majority. Michael Franklin and Deidre DeGeer will bring democracy back to our state. We all need to vote and make sure our votes count. And that's signed by Patricia Levin from Iowa City. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, August 9, on IRIS. And now we turn to the obituary today. First from Atkins, Arlen M. Gerhold, age 87, died Sunday, August 7. Phillips Funeral Home in Vinton is in charge. From Kalmar, John Meyer, age 94, died Tuesday, August 2. Helms Funeral Home, Jacora. In Cloutier, Jean Ellen Miller, age 82, of Ankeny, formerly of Cloutier, died Friday, August 5. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home, Tama, Toledo. In Manchester, Merlin, known as Dick Pullman, age 75, died Saturday, August 6. Bonencamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service, Manchester. In North English, Nancy, known as Joey Arlene Butler, age 77, died Friday, August 5. The Powell Funeral Home in North English is in charge. In Urbana, Thomas E. Cannon, age 70, died Saturday, August 6. Iowa Cremation in Cedar Rapids is in charge of those arrangements. And in another death, Michael E. Germier, age 82, of Mesa, Arizona, formerly of Waukon and Urbandale, died Sunday, July 17. The Martin Grau Funeral Home in Waukon is assisting the family. Moving now to the regular notices, first from Cedar Rapids, Daniel Han Lewis, age 38, died from a motorcycle accident in Cedar Rapids, July 27. A private family gathering will be held in honor of Daniel's life on earth. From Palo, Gay F. Clymer, age 82, died Friday, August 5, at Northbrook Manor Care Center. Tian Funeral Home is serving the family. In Cedar Rapids, Jeanette Ann Benzing, age 83, passed away Sunday, August 7, following a short illness. A memorial service will be held at 1 p.m. Sunday, August 14, at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation in Cedar Rapids. Also in Cedar Rapids, Robert G. Bumstead, age 97, passed away Saturday, August 6, at Terrace Glen Villages. A private family funeral service will be held at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories in Cedar Rapids. Memorials may be directed to the family for a donation to the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. In Victor, Ruth Jallis, age 99, of Victor, died Saturday, August 6, at the English Valley Care Center in North English. A funeral service will be held at 10 a.m. Saturday, August 13, at St. John's Lutheran Church, south of Victor. Interment will be at St. John's Lutheran Cemetery. A reception will follow at St. John's Lutheran. Visitation will begin at 2 p.m. Friday, August 12, at the Smith Funeral Home in Victor, and her family will receive friends from 4 to 7 p.m. Memorials may be designated to St. John's Lutheran Church or to Essence of Life Hospice. Smith Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. From Clarence, Robert King Kelly, age 88, died Saturday, August 6, at St. Luke's Hospice Unit in Cedar Rapids. A celebration of life is being planned at 10:30 a.m. Saturday, August 13, at St. John's United Church of Christ in Clarence. Pastor Matt Schneider Adams will be officiating. Visitation will be from 5 to 8 p.m. Friday, August 12, at St. John's United Church of Christ. Burial will follow at Clarence Cemetery. From Cedar Rapids, Rose Dorothy Poodle, age 83, died Monday, August 8, at Methwick Community after a short illness. Services are at 11 a.m. Thursday at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, Friends may visit with the family at the church on Thursday, an hour before the service. Tien Funeral Home is serving the family. In Amana, Connie S. Roth, age 72, of Middle Amana, formerly of Brooklyn, passed away Sunday, August 7th at Compass Memorial Healthcare in Marengo after a five-year courageous battle with ALS. A funeral service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 12th at the Michael J. Manat Community Center in Brooklyn, with Ed and Marcia Kincaid officiating. Visitation will be from 4 to 8 p.m. Thursday, August 11th at Kloster Funeral Home in Brooklyn. Burial will be in the Ivy Hill Cemetery in Malcolm. Memorials may be contributed in Connie's name to the ALS Association. In Ely, Robert, known as Bob Crapful, age 60, passed away Sunday, August 7, at St. Luke's Hospital in Cedar Rapids. Services will be held at 2 p.m. Thursday, August 11, at First Lutheran in Cedar Rapids, followed by a celebration of life. Visitation will take place from 4 to 7 p.m. Wednesday, August 10, at Cedar Memorial Chapel of Memories Stateroom. Burial will be Friday at Coggins Cemetery. Cedar Memorial is in charge of arrangements. Memorial donations may be directed to Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center Sarcoma Research Program at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics or Unity Point Hospice at St. Luke's Hospital. In Shueyville, Duane Joseph Krobe, age 80, of Shueyville, passed away Sunday, August 7th at the Birdhouse Hospice Home of Johnson County. Visitation will be from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 11th at St. Mary's Catholic Church. Funeral Mass will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 12th at St. Mary's in Solon, with Father Charles Fleming presiding. Burial will be in Saints Peter and Paul Cemetery. Brosh Chapel and the Ava Center in Solon are in charge of arrangements. In Hardin, Kentucky, Richard Allen Boston passed away. Interment will be at 9:30 a.m. Friday, August 12, at the Iowa Veterans Cemetery in Adel. A gathering of family and friends will be held immediately afterward at the American Legion Post 403. That's at 910 Main Street in Van Meter, Iowa. From Stanwood, Laura Lee Thuma, age 97, passed away Sunday, August 7th, at Cedar Manor Nursing Home in Tipton. A memorial service celebrated Laura's life will be held at a later date at the Stanwood Union Church. She will be buried next to her husband in the Stanwood Cemetery. Chapman Funeral Home is assisting the family. From Monticello, William Leo, known as Bill Bolkin, 78, of Monticello, passed away Sunday, August 7th at the Jones Regional Medical Center in Anamosa. Visitation will be held from 3 to 5 Thursday, August 11th at the Wayne Zion Lutheran Church in Monticello. Funeral services will begin at 5 p.m. Thursday, August 11th at Wayne Zion Lutheran Church. Pastor Wade Reddy will officiate. A private family burial will be held following the services. Kramer Funeral Home is assisting the family. And our final obituary from Marion Willard, known as Bill Nagel Sperry, age 92, of Marion, formerly of Marengo, passed away Thursday, August 4, at Unity Point Transitional Care in Cedar Rapids. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place. Family will greet friends and family from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, August 11th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. A funeral liturgy outside of the Mass will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, August 12th, at the funeral home with Deacon Dennis Turns officiating. Committal services with military honors will follow at the Oak Shade Cemetery in Marion. Memorials in Bill's memory may be made to the Ed and Joan Hemphill Hospice Unit at St. Luke's Hospital. Murdoch Funeral Home is assisting the family with arrangements. Turning now to the sports page, Under Construction is the title of this article by Jeff Johnson. It's right there in the background, taunting them all, especially the seniors. The football field and track at Marion High School isn't completed. The LED lights are up. The locker room buildings look fairly close to being done. But there's a long way to go before the Wolves' new den is ready. We've had shipping delays, construction delays, then you've had to worry about weather and all that kind of jazz, said Marion coach Michael Joyner during Monday afternoon's first practice, the sounds of workers making progress on the facility in the background. Right now, we're not in that mindset that we're worrying about where we play. We can't control it. Where Joyner's football squad will play its home game this season is back at historic Thomas Park, not what was anticipated. Even worse for the Wolves is the new stadium was where the old practice field was located, directly behind the school. Marion is having to practice on the school's soccer field instead. This fits the pattern of recent seasons for the program, unfortunately. A derecho destroyed Thomas Park and forced Marion to play its 2020 home games at Linmar Stadium. Thomas Park was rebuilt enough to allow games to be played there last season. We can see the progress being made, Joyner said. If we can get done 1 week ahead of schedule, we can play one game there, but we're not holding our breath. Marion's opener is August 26th at Clear Creek Amana, with its home opener the following week against Cedar Rapids, Washington. The regular season finale is October 21 against Waterloo East at home, whether that's Thomas Park or the new stadium. I mean, I've always liked Thomas Park, senior Alex Mota said. It has so much tradition behind it. If this is ready, it's ready, but I kind of like Thomas Park. Mota is a University of Iowa signee who will play a different position than the previous two seasons. He's moving from quarterback to slot receiver. Sophomore Caleb Deers will be the new quarterback. I'm really happy to play a position I want to play, Mota said, to get the ball in space, make guys miss, and score touchdowns. I think it's going to be good for me and the team. And this high school volleyball story is by Jeff Linder, titled Homework Starts Now for Marion. The first day of practice begins with players entering their thoughts into journals. The first day of class is 2 weeks away. Homework, though, that starts now. Coach Roxanne Paulson sent her Marion High School volleyball squad out with an assignment Monday following the first day of practice. It centered on reading about something she called the four C's: composure, concentration, confidence, and commitment. For the Wolves, there's more to volleyball than volleyball. They started practice with a 10-minute session of writing into journals. They'll do that from now till the season ends, which they hope is sometime in early November. Journaling, it sets the tone for the day, said Paulson, who has built an enviable program in her first 18 years at Marion. 556 victories, 9 state tournaments, and a championship in 2008. It's a good way to set goals, build competitiveness, and become more mentally tough. The Wolves are coming off another memorable season, a 37-9 record, a share of the Walmart Conference East Division title, a berth in the Class 4A state semifinals. 5 starters are back, led by 4A first-team All-Stater Avery Van Hook, a senior who has committed to the University of South Dakota. Last year, Van Hook served a dual role as setter and hitter. She anticipates being the primary setter this season. That's the way it's going to be at college, she said. Whatever the team wants is what I'm going to need. Whatever is needed, whatever it takes, that's a common theme with this team. Turning to the community page, here are some stories of area interest. The playground in the Ped Mall at Iowa City closes for renovation. This story by Isabella Zaluska. The playground on Iowa City's Ped Mall will be closed for the next 6 to 8 weeks as a long-awaited revamp is undertaken. The playground, which closed for renovations Monday, will be removed before the new equipment and surfacing is installed. The area will be fenced off so demolition of the current playground can begin. The playground was last replaced 20 years ago. The estimated cost is $234,000. Construction remains on schedule. The new playground could be ready in late September or early October. And here are some things to do today. Kid-friendly mobile technology lab. The library is partnering with Cedar Rapids Parks and Rec's Rolling Rec Mobile. That is at Hayes Park today from 1:30 to 3:30. Learn about more specific topics within the field of ecology. Come prepared to walk trails and, depending on the topic, get a little dirty. That's at the Prairie Woods Franciscan Spirituality Center in Hiawatha from 4 to 6 today. Cost is $20. And history, oral histories alive. Rob Cook's lineage dates back to the founding fathers of Cedar Rapids. His knowledge of the progress and development of Cedar Rapids is second to none. Cook is also a retired educator and former president of the History Center's Board of Directors. He'll be presenting at 6 p.m. today at the History Center, 800 2nd Avenue Southeast in Cedar Rapids. That is free. And in Iowa City, this story by Sabine Martin, audio experience transforms downtown Iowa City streets. Downtown Iowa City now has a different kind of public art installation, one that isn't visible at first glance. The Parking Spaces is a site-specific listening, asynchronous experience curated by three local artists. Choreographer Stephanie Miracle, composer Raymond Rochando, and writer-poet Stephen Willis collaborated with 10 artists to bring phase two of their project, which originally started during the height of the pandemic. The main goal was to offer locals in Iowa City an experience that was reorienting them to a place they already lived or spent time in, she said. The Parking Spaces is a 1 to 2 hour long experience, inviting participants to go to each listening location that is scattered downtown. The project is funded by a $5,000 Iowa Arts Council grant. Parking Spot 1 by poet Caleb Rainey and the group Wavecage features jazz music layered on top of a spoken word poem that asks the listener to start at the Capitol Street parking ramp and walk by the ramp to look at the Oracles of Iowa City mural on the side of the ramp. Other tracks invite the listener to move their body or imagine certain things while a narrator tells a story of spoken word poem, Miracle said. There are others that just invite you to sit and listen. For example, the Family Folk Machine does a really playful upbeat cover of Mr. Blue Sky. If you go, it's called the Parking Space. 11 spots in downtown Iowa City that take a little over an hour to walk through. All spots are wheelchair accessible. The exhibit is available for public listening 24/7. Audio tracks are accessible to download and are streamable. Participants can check out an MP3 player and a headphone set from the Iowa City Public Library or get a transcribed copy of the audio on the Parking Spaces page, parkingspaces.com/map. And the cost, of course, is free. Here are some Eastern Iowa briefs. First, in Maquoketa, learn about the management of Jackson County Conservation's rare and sensitive remnant prairies, 2 p.m. August 20th at the Hurstville Interpretive Center in Maquoketa. Naturalist Tony Vorwald will talk about the remnant prairies and current and ongoing registration projects. In Cedar Rapids, Women's Art Festival is set for September 3 at the Nubo City Market. The 2022 Women's Art Festival to honor and celebrate women through musical performances, visual art demonstrations, and culinary arts will be held from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. September 3 at Nubo City Market. There also will be large arts guest vendor markets at this free event. In Cedar Rapids, the Greater Cedar Rapids Community Foundation has once again partnered with Donors Choose to match gifts to help fund classroom projects in Linn County. Currently, 58 projects are posted on donorschoose.org by Linn County teachers seeking support for math and reading supplies, STEM activities, and more. The foundation will provide a one-to-one match for each donation, with a total cost of $2,000 or less. The foundation will donate up to $25,000 in total. In 2021, 59 teachers from 23 Linn County schools participated and 111 projects were funded. On the Business 380 page, this Bloomberg News story, Whirlpool to buy waste disposal business. Whirlpool agreed to buy InSinkErator, Emerson Electric's garbage disposal business, in a $3 billion transaction. The all-cash deal is expected to close in the fourth quarter of this year, subject to regulatory approval. It's expected to add about $1.25 to Whirlpool's earnings per share in its 2023 fiscal year. The brand will operate as a separate business within the North American region, which accounts for more than half of the appliance maker's sales. The transaction comes as Whirlpool conducts a review of its business to concentrate on areas with high growth and margin potential by focusing on the Americas, on countertop appliances, and on the commercial segment. Whirlpool operates a manufacturing facility in Amana. Finishing up with the weather page today, the normal high is 82, and we're looking for a high of 80 in Cedar Rapids, also in Iowa City. Our normal low is 62, and we're looking for a low right in that area, 58 for Cedar Rapids and Iowa City both today. Mostly sunny today and tomorrow, partly cloudy towards the end of the week. Sunset tonight at 8:15 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 6:09 a.m. That gives us 14 hours and 7 minutes of daylight. And we are in the waxing gibbous moon phase with moon rise at 5:58 p.m., moon set at 2:42 a.m. In the temperature category, we set a record high of 104 degrees back in 1913 and a record low of 43 degrees in 1927. That does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Tuesday, August 9. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access a copy of today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thanks for listening and have a great, safe day.
People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now, researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.